This episode of Gunblog Varietycast brought to you by LawOfSelfDefense.com. Go to LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety to learn about your state's self-defense laws. Sign up for one of their online or in-person seminars or buy the book Law of Self-Defense and get 10% off when you use the discount code VARIETY at checkout. That's LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety. Sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, episode 53. Welcome back to the Gunblog Variety Cast. I'm your host, Sean from NC Gunblog, and with me today is Adam from Guns, Cars, Tech Blog. How are you doing, Adam?
I don't think I'm ever sleeping again. That's really what it is. I mean, he's almost a year old. What the hell?
You sent me this email right before we started to record. Gonna be a little late. Devil children.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't get any hate mail this week. Poor Adam. You're crying.
I know.
Mop up your tears. But I did get something from a guy named John. I recommended that everybody listen to my audio narration from Podcastle. I did say that it was not safe for work and a little strange. Is that a good way to put it? Did I say something
yes.
to that? It was
You basically said, I did this thing, please don't listen to it.
I did not.
Well, you didn't
definitely listen to it. I'm very proud of it. You're probably not gonna like this story, but I did a good job. And from John I get, so I just listened to your narration of Ink and WTF did I just listen to, which I thought was very funny.
He listened to the thing that you exactly described he was going to listen to.
Yeah. And I'm very proud of the work I did. I did the work that they asked me to do. It's not a story that I would have written, but I think I did a good job with it. And there's some other stuff that I've done that I think is, you know, I like the stories better. And so I recommended The Colors, which is about a 16-minute short story as part of a larger episode that I did a while back. I said something about it on the podcast a couple of months ago. I just thought that was pretty funny. So thanks for the mail, John. And thank you for listening to the podcast. Hopefully that means that they will say, oh, look, lots of people listen to this podcast. We'll give him more stuff to read. And maybe I'll get to the point where I can pick and choose what I read. So let's get started with the Tactical Dog and Fitness Report. 22.6 dog walking miles. And I'm trying to teach Dices the proper way to return to a heel when she brings me back a ball or a frisbee. I've been kind of letting her slack on that.
I wish Tactical Dog would ever bring me back a ball or a frisbee. Part of the reason why she's not an actual tactical dog is that's like a requirement. They bring the thing back to the handler.
I've never understood that. Are they supposed to go out and get the drug and bring it back to them if they're sniffing drugs? Are they supposed to go get the criminal and bring him back to you?
No, that's basically a reward mechanism thing. It's some proxy for telling how trainable a dog is. So there's that. Also, I actually saw Tactical Dog's trainer the other day. We were in line at L&L Hawaiian, which is a Hawaiian fast food place that just opened here in Nashville. But yeah, he was in there. He's like, oh, hey, how's the pup? I was like, yeah, you wouldn't be too proud of us.
we should have our dogs meet, and then your dog can teach my dog bad habits.
Yes.
Well, now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron Paulette. Today, Aaron's going to talk about water storage.
Come on, every pony. It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Aaron Paulette.
Aaron, for our first episode a year ago, you talked about the importance of water purification and how best to do that. It really set the tone of your segment for the rest of the year. How would you like to start your next year on Blue Collar Prepping?
That's a great question. I'm going to start by talking about the importance of water storage. Now, as I've mentioned in previous segments, water is bulky and heavy, which makes it difficult to transport in an emergency. But if you plan to weather a disaster inside your home, bugging in prepper parlance, then transportation isn't an issue. But this water still takes up space, so here are some effective ways to gather and store water. First of all, if you have a well on your property or are above an aquifer, then by all means, you should get a hand pump installed. Now be aware that this won't be cheap. Digging a well and installing a pump is expensive, several hundreds of dollars. But in the long run, it will pay off. The Earth can store water much more efficiently than we can, and best of all, it isn't conspicuous. Just make sure that your pump is kept in good order and that you can maintain positive control over it. That means being able to see it and see who's using it. If necessary, you can put a padlock on it or build a shed over it. The drawback to this system is that it can be exhausting to pump all this water. Now, you can get electrical pumps, of course, but those require either city power or a further investment in off-grid electricity. Now, rain catchment is another great way to store water. You can buy 55-gallon drums of food-grade plastic at Amazon or other stores for around $100 and position them under gutter spouts. These will fill up after enough rainfall, which means very little effort exerted in gathering the water. You just do basic maintenance on the gutters and the downspouts. However, water that is just sitting there is likely to have things fall in it, like leaves or dirt or even animals. And even with a good pre-filter, algae is likely to grow in water that's just sitting there. Now, this doesn't mean the water is bad, mind you. It just means that you will need to filter and then purify it before you drink it. Now, some states may prohibit you from storing rainwater due to local regulations, so be sure to check your laws before you invest in this. Water in store-bought bottles is great for a while until you open the seal. Then you'll need to use it as soon as possible. Now, you can also store water in previously used bottles, but they need to be cleaned thoroughly. Now, don't use anything that's held milk or fruit juices, because milk protein and fruit sugars are really difficult to remove from these bottles and can promote the growth of algae or bacteria. Glass or stainless steel containers are fine, but they're heavy and the glass can break. I find that 2-liter soda bottles are perfect for this. They're the right size, they're durable, and they have a tight screw-on cap. Now, before you use them, first you need to clean them with dishwashing soap and water, and then rinse with clean water. Then you sanitize the bottle with 2 teaspoons of unscented liquid household chlorine bleach, and then you fill the bottle again, shake, and rinse. The bottle is now ready for use. I recommend that you use clear bottles so that you can see the quality of water inside without having to open it. But you also want to store them in a dark place. Keep them out of sunlight. This will prevent the bottles from breaking down and will keep the algae from growing, as it will do if you store it in sunlight. So keep them in cool, dark places. Now, personally, I like to fill mine only 3/4 full and put them in the freezer. That way, if we lose power, the ice will keep the food fresh longer, and as the ice melts, we can drink it. Now, if you're really gung-ho about water storage, you can buy items called water bricks. These are sealable boxes of food-grade plastic that are designed to stack together like Legos, and you can store these under beds or stack them in a closet, just anywhere you have some spare room. Now, they are a bit pricey, though. $25 for a single 3.5-gallon container.
Now, I was just looking on Amazon, and you can get 8 of them for $160, basically, free shipping. So they dropped to $20 in bulk.
There you go. Now, whichever way you go, you want to store your water away from toxic substances like gasoline or pesticide, just to avoid any risk of cross-contamination. So don't keep them out in the garage. It's generally recommended that you change out your stored water every 6 months. I'm not sure if it's necessary to do it that often, especially if you have a lot of water storage, because that'll be a lot of replacing and filling. But it's certainly good to do an inspection that often. Do it at the time change, when you're checking your smoke alarms and changing out batteries, and replace any bottles that are damaged or look iffy. Finally, water that's been stored a while may taste flat or otherwise be unappealing. You can fix that pretty easily by pouring it from container to container. This introduces oxygen to the water and makes it taste fresher and cleaner.
These all sound like great ideas, Aaron. Is there anything else?
I have one thing that's related to water purification. Way back in episode 10, I talked about the water pasteurization indicator, a small and foolproof piece of kit that lets you know when water is safe without having to bring it all the way to a boil.
Oh yeah, that was a pretty cool idea.
Well, as it happens, one of my fellow blue-collar prepping bloggers is trying to get a group buy of these whoppies for less than they cost at Amazon. The current cost for the group is $6 each, but if you buy five or more, that drops to $5 each.
I just looked up those on Amazon too, and they're like $8 a piece.
Yeah, it's a good deal. So we need 100 purchases to make this group buy happen, and so far we only have around 30. So if you're interested, please visit our blog or our Facebook page and express an interest, and we can get this group buy happening.
All right, I'm going to get me a couple.
That's great, Sean. I'll put you down for two.
All right, Aaron. It was good to talk with you. See you again soon.
See you soon.
If you'd like to read more from Aaron, check out her blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com. And I have a terrible, unholy desire for those water bricks. They're like three. They're like super engineered. They got like holes in the center of them, and they stack like bricks, and they lock together. And when you stack them correctly, the holes line up, so you could like drive a pipe down to like hold up, and you can build like walls with it. I don't know if I want to store any water or any food in them. I think I just want to fill them with water so they don't fly away, and then play with them, like make a fort in the backyard. They're really cool.
I'm picturing this, and
they're actually pretty neat. You can fill them up to a certain line and then freeze them, and you have this 3.5 gallon ice block
that weighs.
Well, you put it in your cooler where you would put that much ice anyway, right, and there you're cold. Your drinks are cold, and you don't have to fish through the cold water.
Interesting.
Felons behaving badly. Missing transgender woman found dead in crude grave in North Carolina. The body of Elisha Walker, a 20-year-old transgender woman who had been missing for almost a year, was found in a crude grave in Johnston County, North Carolina. For those not familiar with North Carolina geography, I live in Wake County, Raleigh area. Johnston County is about 10 miles south of here.
Okay.
According to advocates and local media, the discovery was made more than 100 miles from Walker's home in Salisbury, North Carolina. A Latin Kings gang member, suspect 23, was arrested and charged with killing Walker and stealing her car, reports said on Thursday. He was being held without bond. Amid reports from Detroit, Texas, and Phoenix of the deaths of three more black transgender women, some observers have placed the number of transgender women killed this year at 16. Walker was reported missing in November 2014 after her family had not heard from her since 24 October, the Salisbury Post reported. Police gave local media information about Walker's disappearance in an effort to generate leads, but few were forthcoming until Walker's burnt-out 2000 Pontiac Sunfire was discovered in an open field in Sampson County, police said in a release. Suspect had lived in a house in Salisbury that Walker was known to frequent before moving to Johnston County, more than 100 miles away, where he was arrested on unrelated drug charges. Rowan County police obtained a search warrant for Johnston County house, they said. They discovered Walker's body in a, quote, small depression behind it. Suspect will not face hate crimes charges over Walker's death. North Carolina does not have a hate crime statute. Like other police departments around the country, Rowan County Sheriff's Office has repeatedly referred to Walker with the incorrect pronoun him, despite it being widely acknowledged that Walker identified as a transgender woman. The department did not return a request for comment. So, what sort of person do you figure is a Latin Kings gang member murdered his person who frequented his house, toted the body more than 100 miles across North Carolina, and buried it in his own backyard?
I'm going to go with felon.
Shoplifting, 11-11-2009, misdemeanor class 1. Common law robbery attempted, 5-20-2010, felon class H. Common law robbery conspiracy, 5-20-2010, felon class H. DWI level 4-10-8-2011, misdemeanor, non-class code. Fictitious info to law enforcement officer, 10-8-2011, misdemeanor class 2. And driver's license revoked attempted, 10-8-2011, misdemeanor class 1. I'm not entirely certain how one attempts to drive with a driver's license revoked, but apparently that's what this person was charged with. And we can see by his age that he got an early start, his shoplifting at 17, almost 18 years, and his common law robbery, he was like just barely past 18.
Nice guy.
It's going to be a little difficult for him to argue in court that he had no idea how this person that he knew ended up buried in a shallow grave in his backyard 100 miles from where that person lived.
Total coincidence.
Total.
Just total coincidence.
In this week's Foreign Policy for Grownups, do you wonder what's the big deal about the Clinton email scandal? Well, even if you don't care about Monica's ex-boyfriend's wife, who was running a secret email server out of some guy in Colorado's bathroom, Nikki explains why Hillary's total lack of good judgment should exclude her from ever holding any position of trust. So Nikki, Hillary Clinton's email scandal seems to be growing bigger and bigger. We're hearing more emails should have been classified at a pretty high level. Could this tank her White House ambitions?
Well, Sean, I think the bigger question is, should it tank her White House ambitions? The fact that she somehow had classified information on a private server should be concerning enough. There's no such thing as classified information that belongs to an individual. All classified information belongs to the U.S. government. And the fact that she had it on her private server is a problem, a big one. Clinton used the domain address at clintonemail.com for her private email. Simple tests conducted by cyber experts suggest that the domain may have been vulnerable. Gee, you think? The fact that the Chinese and other malicious actors can penetrate our networks is worrisome. And those are government networks, for Pete's sake. Remember the OPM breach? Remember the National Guard data breach? I'd venture to say that despite their obvious faults, their servers are just a little more secure than the server from Platte River Networks, which was apparently kept in a cabinet in a bathroom of some little apartment in Colorado. When a news reporter asked Hillary recently if she had wiped the server clean...
You were in charge of it. You were the official in charge. Did you wipe the server?
What, like with a cloth or something?
I don't know.
Well,
you
no.
know how it works digitally. Did you try to wipe the whole thing?
I don't know how it works digitally at all. I do not have any...
You did not try.
Seriously, like a moron. Little did we imagine the joke, considering where the server was kept, wiping the server clean. Those problems are all bad. Potential compromise of classified information. State secrets dumped onto a private server. Potential attempts to hide evidence. But there's actually a bigger aspect to all this that should give anyone pause before supporting Hillary for president. First, she claims she never sent any classified emails. Even if this were true, she sure as hell received them. As a presidential daily brief or PDB customer, she should have been very well versed in what could be deemed classified information. Her claim that she didn't know the information was classified because the classification headers and portion marks were removed means, well, she's either lying or incompetent. So either one should be a disqualifier for the presidency. And speaking of incompetence...
What, like with a cloth or something?
Like with a cloth or something? Really?
What, like with a cloth or something?
Yeah, cloth or something. With that contrived New York accent, it just about makes me want to punch a wall. If this supposedly intelligent woman doesn't know what wiping a server means, she has no business being in the White House. But hey, you know what? She stayed with Bill after his numerous dalliances, so she may not be as smart as she would have us believe in the first place. Third, she's acting like she doesn't consider this data spill a big deal. Apparently, no one else talks to her about this other than the media, so it might not be a big deal. Let's forget about the fact that the average American wouldn't know a classification marking from their own butthole. So the fact that top secret information is defined as information the release of which could cause exceptionally grave damage. Let me repeat that. Exceptionally grave damage to America's national security. Even if the average American is dumb as a post and doesn't understand the release of TS information is a big deal, a former sex state should certainly know and understand this. And if she doesn't, she's once again too incompetent to run the country. Fourth, she refuses to take responsibility for her wrongdoing. Once again, it's the right-wing conspiracy. Once again, it's Republicans using this incident to attack her over Benghazi. It's not her fault. It's really not a big deal. Hell, it's just classified information, right? I mean, Marcel Lazar Lahel, a Romanian hacker also known as Gucci Fur, breached the email account of Sidney Blumenthal, a former Clinton aide, who sent emails to her at her clintonemails.com address, and then leaked those emails to the world, published by the Russian-funded propaganda machine RT. So the Russians now have access to some U.S. classified information they may not have had access to if it wasn't for Hillary. But hey, it's no big deal, she says, shrugging. I would submit that anyone who doesn't understand why the data spill of this kind is important, and more importantly, refuses to take responsibility for it, has neither the comprehension nor the integrity to hold the highest office in the land.
So what happens in the unlikely event that the FBI can't recover the wiped information from the Clinton drive?
Well, maybe we should ask the Russians or the Chinese or, like, the Romanians for it, right? I think that in and of itself is a security threat. When anyone is granted a clearance, they're evaluated partly to determine how susceptible they are to being blackmailed into disclosing classified information, whether it's money problems or relatives serving in foreign governments or anyone else with whom the person has close and continuing contact that could be used as a point of blackmail. So what happens if the Russians or the Chinese, for instance, have Hillary's information, everything she's wiped from that server? Heck, it could be as innocuous as discussions about TV shows or as serious as information about collection platforms and other sources and methods we use to collect information. How much do you think she would pay? What do you think she would do to keep that information from being released? This makes her a national security risk. If she can be blackmailed into acting counter to the interests of the country she's, dog forbid, elected to lead with the threat of releasing that information, I want her nowhere near the White House. So, do you watch the show Scandal?
Nope, never heard of it.
Well, okay, so that particular show is kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. It's not realistic in the least bit. However, in it, the President of the United States is having an affair with and falls in love with this woman other than his wife. Madly in love. And an unsavory character knows it. So he kidnaps her and tries to force him to start a war by threatening to kill her. So again, I ask you, what would happen if the Russians or the Chinese or any other adversary that has access to the info that was actually contained on her server decided to threaten her with release? What would she do to protect that information? Would she go to war? What would she do? So you see, the problem is actually much greater than Hillary mishandling classified info and then lying about it. Hell, we're pretty much used to Clinton lies right about now, aren't we? The overall implications absolutely should disqualify her from getting anywhere near the White House other than as a tourist.
All right, Nikki. It was good to talk with you. See you again soon.
You bet. Take care.
Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com. Plug of the week. Have you ever wondered how do Sean and Adam get such great audio quality? I bet they spent hundreds of dollars on their microphone. You're laughing.
I am laughing.
Why are you laughing so hard?
Just the way you said that.
I'm modest, too. Yep, all this in modesty, too. You might expect that microphones are really expensive and, you know, I'll just get a headset or something like that. Maybe you want to do a little bit of recording. You might want to be a guest on a podcast, or you just want to be able to narrate for a, you know, video that you've made. Any number of good reasons why you might want to be able to record audio. Don't spend a lot of money.
No.
Seriously, don't do it.
But spend more than $15. Because that was the first microphone that I had.
Oh, really?
When we did that first test podcast a year ago, I had a $15 microphone, and it was terrible.
It was terrible. And don't try to record with the microphone in your laptop.
Oh, yeah. No, that's bad.
There's two microphones I'm going to put in the show notes. The Audio-Technica ATR-2100 USB and the Audio-Technica AT-2005 USB. They're both USB microphones that you can also use with XLR. If you don't have any idea what XLR is, don't worry. If you don't know what it is, you don't need it. But you could use it later like I'm doing now. What you really care about is it's a USB microphone. Plug and play. Plug it into your computer. It figures out what it's supposed to do, and it powers up, and boom, you have a microphone.
Comes with a nifty little stand.
It does. I would say spend the extra money and get yourself a little arm to put it on and a little pop filter to put it in front of. But, you know, you're really getting high tech there. You know, when the prices are as low as they normally get, you're talking a whole $85 for the entire setup. Right now, the 2005 USB, that's the microphone I have, right now on Amazon is $79, which is way more expensive than it should be. I wouldn't pay more than $55 for these things. Right now, the ATR-2100 USB is $58. That's a lot closer to the price that I'd be willing to pay. The internals on these microphones are exactly the same. There's not one thing to recommend one of those over the other one. So if you ever think you're going to need a microphone, put both of these in your Amazon wish list and just check them once in a while and see if the price has dropped. When you see the price drop down into the 50s, 55, 52, jump on it and buy it then. How much are you going to spend for a headset? $35, $40?
Yeah.
$50? Why spend $50 for a headset? It's not going to be anything like the audio quality you get out of these microphones. Just buy one of these and you're going to have really good audio quality. You'll be proud of it and you won't be popping the mic so much. Because those boom mics are just awful to deal with. If you're trying to get, now if all you're doing is talking to your friends while you're playing video games, yeah.
This actually wouldn't be a good candidate for replacement for something that you're talking to your friends while you're video gaming.
Yeah, this is really not a good idea. But if you have any interest in having good audio, this is the way to go. Watch the prices, wait till they drop in the 55 or lower category, and as soon as they do, pick one up. Well, this week's special guest is the former deputy sheriff, a mental health professional, and a combative arts instructor, William April. William explains to us how assuming that a criminal thinks the same way you do is a very bad idea. William April is a licensed mental health professional with over 15 years' experience across the continuum of care. He presently maintains a private practice and consultancy specializing in post-traumatic interventions and other disciplines. William is a former deputy sheriff and special deputy U.S. Marshal. He is a decorated competitive shooter and has taught civilian, law enforcement, and military personnel in various fighting skills since 1990. He maintains an active schedule both as a student and a teacher, having been instructor rated by several top-tier trainers and studying under many of the most influential members of the combative arts community. Welcome to the show, William.
Well, thanks for having me. I really do appreciate it.
William, I've noticed that most people assume that everyone's pretty much just like them. We all seem to believe that everyone is working from the same basic assumptions. The problem, as I see it, is that if criminals had the same motives as the rest of us, they'd be productive citizens, just like the rest of us. Criminals must be operating off a different set of assumptions. If we project our motives and desires on criminal actors, doesn't that lead us to underestimate them? What drives criminals to do what they do, and how must we think in order to stay out of their trap?
Well, I think it's important to grasp that there is a governing structure to the mindset of a violent criminal actor. Their behavior isn't random or unpredictable once you get inside that framework. The easiest way to think about it is that we're trying to get through the day with a minimum of muss and fuss. Well, the violent criminal actor is trying to do the same thing, but the means to that goal can be entirely different. How we think about them, though, can be limited by the kind of person we are. If I'm a decent, God-fearing sort, I would imagine that the next person I run into on the street in my daily life is going to be a decent, God-fearing sort of person, too. Well, the problem with that is if they're not, I'm unprepared, but not only unprepared, I'm actually prepared not to see them. I know that sounds like a strange way to put it, but there's almost a kind of invisibility. If we cannot conceive of something, then we simply cannot see it. Cases after cases of murders by people where, as a defensively aware reader, you'll say, how could they not have seen this going off the rails? How could they not have seen that letting someone into their home was a terrible idea, or that extending themselves for someone unknown to them was a terrible idea and it left them vulnerable to be exploited? But they cannot conceive of someone exploiting them, mostly because they can't conceive of themselves ever exploiting someone in that same way. It's so common it has a name. We call it projection bias. Taking my own values and projecting them onto the world as if the world were a screen and I were a movie projector, thinking that the same rules govern everyone. And I think it's fair to say that while there is a governing structure, it's not the same one that we have. So it's important to understand the criminal mindset so that you can see the world how they see it, not how it seems to you. There's a quote that's been attributed to a bunch of people, but it really sums up neatly the problem. It says, we see the world not as it is, we see the world as we are. Or as Stephen Covey said, as we are conditioned to see it. Luckily, the vast majority of us aren't really exposed to violent aggression. And so it's easy to think that it just doesn't happen. And it certainly doesn't happen to someone like me, who would never be violent to anyone without, you know, perfectly good reason. So we have to learn to see beyond what we would do and the things that seem reasonable to us. As I said, you've got to create a parking spot in your head for what you might have to do. And that necessitates understanding what someone else might do, whether it makes sense to me or not. Thinking about it in terms of that there is a structure and that we have to learn to avoid its pitfalls and embrace it to use it against a violent criminal actor.
So what drives them to do what they do?
In a large extent, they've been conditioned to think that this is how you get by in the world, that the way you get something is to take it from someone else. There are certain people, sociopaths and psychopaths, that have a genetic basis to their action. They're made that way rather than become that way. But the run-of-the-mill violent criminal actor has been converted into a dangerous creature by a lot of effort on someone else's behalf. Someone has taught them that violence is how you get what you want. And we all have wants and needs, but, you know, I may very well think that if I want a vacation home, well, then, geez, I'm going to have to work really hard to get it. But if I've been taught virtually from the cradle up that the way I get something is by threatening someone else with violence and by using violence against them, then that's what I'll do. But their actions are not random. I don't want people to think that opportunistic crime means random behavior, because then it is unpredictable. Violent criminal actor behavior and their mindset is actually quite predictable, but it requires that you take a normal working psychology and turn it inside out.
What do you mean by turn it inside out?
Well, the normal, you know, when I say to myself, I need to lock the front door, in a sense, I've taken on the mindset of a criminal. The mindset of the criminal is, if that door's open, I'm going to go in it, whether I have the right to or not. Well, when I know that that kind of person exists, I find it very easy to lock my front door. But people who either don't believe or have chosen actively not to believe that that kind of person exists, only then can you leave your front door open. I remember having a long conversation with an acquaintance who doesn't lock her front door, and I would beg her to reconsider that. And she finally said, I'm not willing to live in fear. And what she meant was that I'm not willing to contemplate the fact that people who would enter my house without permission exist. And that's a choice. She has chosen to live in denial. She's chosen to take the reality that surrounds her and not see it. Well, but to see it, you have to acknowledge that it exists. And the best guide to criminal behavior is to take a normal, healthy mindset and, like I said, turn it inside out. I wouldn't go into someone else's house. If I were king of the world, no one would ever have to lock their front door. But the kind of people who will come in without permission exist. And that moment of thinking about them allows me to lock the front door.
So if I understand what you're saying, what I need to do is do basically a little red teaming. What would I do if I was a criminal? How would I do this? Now, how do I counter that?
Absolutely. I'm glad that, you know, that expression red teaming has kind of, you know, getting more popular. But it's an excellent way to approach the world. When you think about it, what is the most dangerous thing I do today? And I've had people answer the question, well, I don't do anything dangerous. And I say, really? Well, tell me what your life is like. And someone might say, well, I'm a housewife. Okay, that means you stay home alone all day. It means you're going to be out of your house around 3 o'clock picking up kids from school. So those are the most dangerous things you do every day. You fall into a predictable pattern. And if your pattern happens to overlap the pattern of someone who's looking to exploit, you know, your vulnerabilities, that thing you do that's patterned is in itself the most dangerous thing you do that day. You know, there's no zero risk model.
All right, William, it was good to talk with you. See you again soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can get training with William April at mdtstraining.com. I swear this guy could probably fill out an entire 8-hour day of just telling the crazy stories of, like, wow, the world is not what I thought it was. I've listened to him on several podcasts, and he tells the craziest stories about, like, dude robbed a place. He was a very high-end burglar, and he was done with his burglary, and he goes to walk out, and the other guy who owns the house is asleep on the couch, so he's got some extra time, so he killed him and skinned him.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a thought that'll fester.
Fun with headlines.
You know, usually we try to cover things where the headline says one thing and the article says something else. This one is just stupid. Why did this merit an article?
Okay.
Unknown dangers can be deadly to children. Blink, blink.
Thank you, Captain Obvious?
Exactly. So the first 10 paragraphs of this story are about how this one kid this one time impaled himself on his handlebars. And then it says, oh, by the way, kids can also get hot and dehydrated and struck by cars.
You know what? That is a totally unknown danger. My parents never told me to stay out of streets and not get run over by a car 35 years ago.
Right.
Totally unknown.
And I love this that they throw in here.
According to Hasbro Children's Hospital, doctors see twice as many of these injuries during the summer months than they do during the school year. These injuries being children struck by cars. Shocker of shockers, when you lock children in a brick building for 9 hours a day, they're less likely to be struck by cars.
Yeah, it takes a little more to get to them when they're inside the building.
A little bit.
I mean, you could get to them if you really try.
Maybe if you had a smart car.
What are they going to tell us next? Frostbite more common in December than August?
That's exactly what they're going to say.
Oh, dear.
I guess it was a slow news day. You know, I see these and I save them for later, right? Because I think this one came out at the beginning of summer, and I'm like, oh, that's great. That's just fantastic.
Well, I'll make sure to run straight downstairs and show it to your wife, just in case she hadn't considered the possibility that one of your two children might wander into the street and be struck by those newfangled things they have nowadays called cars.
Yeah, it's not like every day I tell Ben, hey, put the hand on the truck while I'm putting your brother in his car seat, and don't run off.
Yeah, seriously.
Because there's an unknown danger.
So in this age where basically everyone knows that you should have some basic security on your Wi-Fi, who makes a Wi-Fi-enabled device so wide open that even I could hack it? Would you believe drone manufacturers? Baron tells us more in...
Tech Tips.
Tech Tips. Tech Tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech Tips with the Baron.
So Baron, what total security fail did you see this week?
Well, Sean, I saw something so horrible, I could swear these people were working in 1993. Did you hear about the Parrot drone?
Yeah, that was the drone that was on Kickstarter that you can control via Wi-Fi using your phone, right?
Well, let me describe the world that these people live in. Here in Alternate Universe A, little Timmy lives in a perfect world. Everyone lives in a glass house. No one hides anything because there is no crime. Heck, there isn't even simple perversion. In Universe A, we don't even need Andy Griffith as sheriff. No one would dare think about taking anything from anyone else. Even more than that, people don't even try to do something merely to see if they can. They just all blindly follow the rules. Do as the overseer says. For those of you Fallout fans, I'm describing Vault 112 and Tranquility Lane. There's a link in the show notes for those of you who don't know. But here in reality...
Oh no!
Oh no!
Oh no!
Oh no!
Oh no!
Oh no!
Oh yeah!
Yeah, it ends up anyone can control it via Wi-Fi. It has open Wi-Fi, open root, and even an open Telnet server. Let me repeat that. An open Telnet server. The reason that's impressive is because I haven't seen an actual Telnet server since about 2001. Every last terminal interface I've dealt with has been via Secure Shell, otherwise known as SSH. It's encrypted.
So how exactly did this happen? Were they just not thinking or something?
It's worse than that. For the most part, I haven't seen a Telnet server enabled by default in any Linux distro in just about forever. Even worse, if they made their own Yocto build, SSH is available, but they would have had to gone out of their way to install Telnet instead. For everyone, Telnet is like the worst thing in the world, especially on something like Wi-Fi. Anyone can see everything you type, including your password. So I turn on Wireshark on my laptop and pick up your password out of the air as your app logs in. I then log in and start throwing commands at your drone.
That's bad.
Maybe, maybe not. Depends on how gray or black your hat becomes. We've had a few instances of idiots shooting down drones because of idiot hysteria, but this would be a fantastic way to deal with a loitering drone. One, you can see what it sees. Two, you can just land it in your backyard.
Well, actually, that sounds kind of handy.
Yep, especially if you duplicate the footage and just hand the drone over to your police. No damage to property, you don't look like an idiot, and since you were able to see what was going on, you can actually back up your claims. For the most part, you can actually view just about any drone's video feed, because it's usually actually open. None of them are really encrypted. You just have to find it. For those who may not realize this, let me explain something as a guy who flies quote-unquote drones. You can and do get lost. You may not even realize you're over something since you're looking at the horizon through a camera with a narrow field of view. Think like looking through binoculars and trying to figure out where you're standing as you're moving around. Flying them is not as easy as many people think, and people flying them may end up being asses, but they most likely aren't out to cause harm or even be a jerk. So, when you decide to break out the shotgun and shoot one down because it's spying on you, what I and the majority of the rest of the public sees is someone blowing something way out of proportion and destroying someone else's property in the process. To equate it to something within the gun community, you're like an anti-gunner calling 911 because you saw a guy with a gun in his holster. Unless the damn thing is going from window to window, I doubt it's actually spying on you. They make a racket, and people should be polite and respect privacy. But follow it home and talk with them. Range for the most part of these consumer drones is maybe 400 yards. 800 if you have clear line of sight. Deciding to practice your skeet helps no one, and as a member of both communities, every time a drone ends up in the news, I cry a little bit. Each community has boneheads, and they're fantastic at causing problems for the rest of us. Please provide a guiding hand to help them think about what they're doing.
But Baron, this being in the news can't be nearly as bad as someone shooting one down.
Yes, it can, Sean. Now, anyone knows the vulnerability, and when they command the motors to turn off over someone and someone gets injured in the resulting crash, how is that going to look? Security wasn't even a thought regarding this project, nor how the owner would maintain positive control. This makes me think that fail-safes weren't considered as an issue. We have whirling blades that can result in injuries requiring stitches. This is not a toy, it's dangerous. But people view them as toys. Hell, remember the Linux-powered sniper rifle?
No, they didn't.
Well, they did have an open Wi-Fi, and you could firmware update the device and even modify the point of infact and completely hijack it from the user. Now remember, these people were wanting a military contract and wanting to deploy this in combat. Put simply,
you went full retard, man. Never go full retard.
So what you're saying is, actions can have consequences.
Yep, and so can a lack of action and forethought.
All right, Baron. It's good to talk with you. See you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org. Now, I was watching you as you were listening to this for the first time, and he said open telnet server, which is roughly the equivalent of chocolate-flavored manhole covers to me, and you about fell out of your chair.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's exactly right. It's not only rare to see that in the wild, it is actually unheard of and unconscionable to see it in a product that was developed in the last few years. You guys can't see the facepalm, but there was a facepalm.
For those of us who don't have anything to do with computers besides turning them on and turning them off, this is like having sex in front of a window that not only have you opened the drapes, but you took the window out of it?
Yes. A closer analogy would be that you sent your username and password to your father for your bank account on a postcard. Okay? That's really what Telnet is, right? I mean, that's what it is. Now, SSH would be you encrypted the username and the password, and you put it in an envelope, and you put that envelope in an envelope, and then you send it via courier, right?
Okay.
And so that's really what you would want to use. I am blessed to have basically the best job in the entire world. I get to play with drones at work for work purposes, and that's air quote work purposes. So I'm going to be playing with some of this, I think, just to kind of see what's going on. That just, wow.
The J-Block. So I understand that you took the Law of Self-Defense seminar in your hometown of Nashville. How did that go for you?
It went pretty well. Yeah, so it was Arkansas, Mississippi, Kentucky, and Tennessee were all covered, which is good because except for Arkansas, I go to all those states a lot. I've been to Arkansas once. Kentucky, I go to a lot. Mississippi, I go to a lot. So I'm glad that I got the multi-state kind of thing. So yeah, it was a good class. I'd like to thank Andrew for coming out and giving that class. It reinforced a lot of the things that I mostly knew, but the best part was the slides that he gave to me afterwards. He sends out in an email that have all the direct links to all the cases, all the case law. Because that is the thing that is really hard to find. And he actually talks about that in the class, about how you can Google up the statutes and you can probably find the jury instructions. But the case law, unless you have like a professional tool to help you find stuff like that, you just can't. You're not going to.
Yeah, I made the mistake of asking Andrew a specific question about North Carolina law, and he dumped a document dump on me that was like 350 pages long.
He reminds me, I was thinking about this afterwards, he really reminds me a lot of John Lott. If you've ever spent any time with John Lott, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like, the guy is just full of information, and you can ask him, you know, a little bitty question, and he comes back with, like, Encyclopedia Britannica.
So, would it be fair to say that you were pretty well-versed going into the class in Tennessee law?
Yes. I used to be a very active member in the Tennessee Firearms Association, helped get a lot of the legislation that he even talked about passed.
Mm-hmm.
I know more about Tennessee law than most people in Tennessee.
And even knowing all of what you knew to begin with, did you learn something in class?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And so would he be able to convey all of that knowledge to somebody who all they know is, this is, you know, I carry a gun?
Yeah. I do believe that. He's also got the online classes. So if you can't, you know, get to one, if it's too far away or whatever, then I would highly suggest taking an online class. What he said about that in the live class was that you don't get the benefit of actually asking him questions during class. But other than that, it's the same presentation.
It is. Well, he sent me an email after the class saying, hey, by the way, those people in Nashville who want to take the class again, the Nashville Armory was so pleased with his class that they've already booked him to come back February 20th of 2016 and August 20th, 2016. So get signed up now. Use discount code VARIETY for 10% off.
And also, apparently, somebody at the Nashville Armory is a fan. Somebody who works there.
I don't know who did it, but whoever you are that bought a case of 30 Law of Self-Defense and used discount code VARIETY, thank you very much. You made us look totally awesome in front of Andrew.
And if that is somebody at the Armory, email me. I come up there all the time.
Well, the latest advertisement for Moms Demand Illegal Mayors for Every Town, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg Incorporated, uses a pet law enforcement officer to tell Oregonians how wonderful their brand new, unenforceable universal background checks law is. Weird thinks that deserves another patented audio fisk in
This week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
Hey Weird, what do you got this week?
So Oregon's magical background check law recently took effect. And Moms Demand Illegal Mayors for Every Town, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg Incorporated, felt the need to take a victory lap with a 30-second ad.
Oregon's criminal background checks help keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people, like felons and domestic abusers.
Helped is a good word. It doesn't prevent dangerous people from getting guns any more than bans on murder or heroin prevent those crimes. Also, what laws Oregon has on the books are redundant to the Gun Control Act of 1968, so really, Oregon has no claim to exclusivity.
But there was a dangerous and growing loophole. Criminals who wanted guns could find them online and avoid background checks completely. No longer.
Loophole defined. Anything somebody does that isn't illegal and progressives hate. Also, dangerous and growing? Sorry, but where are dangerous criminals buying guns online? This is rapidly becoming an urban legend.
Oregon now requires all gun sales to include a criminal background check through a licensed gun dealer.
But does it?
There are reasonable exceptions. You can still give a gun to an immediate family member or borrow your friend's gun while hunting.
So it isn't all gun sales. Also, the list defines them as transfers by or to law enforcement, transfers between immediate family members, temporary transfers that occur exclusively while in the presence of the owner. So, family members are spouse, domestic partner, parent or step-parent, child, stepchild, sibling, grandparent, grandchild, aunt or uncle, first cousin, niece, nephew, or the spouse or domestic partner at any of the above. Cool that these exceptions are being made, especially given that the states that didn't make these exceptions have been flaunting the law, and law enforcement hasn't been bothering enforcing it. Still, that many exceptions, and you can see how quickly the gun can disappear without a paper trail. It's like playing degrees of Kevin Bacon. FYI, I'm 2 degrees from Kevin Bacon, as the best man at my wedding played in a band that opened for the Bacon Brothers at a concert in Maine. So, lawful citizens might play by the rules, but they might not, as Americans, as well as law enforcement, are well known for ignoring stupid laws. How often do you drive past a traffic cop doing slightly over the posted limit? Criminals will simply continue to ignore the laws. And while private sales are not a loophole, this law makes transferring a gun to a brother's, cousin's, stepmom's, uncle's, brother's, cousin's, live-in boyfriend 100% legal. Also, self-defense is defined as for the purpose of preventing imminent death or serious physical injury, and the provision lasts only as long as is necessary to prevent the death or serious physical injury. So what does this even mean? Is this really just your wife pulling the gun out of your nightstand while the intruder enters the home? Or can I transfer a firearm to a close friend who's currently being stalked until the stalker relents or is jailed? Don't we all carry guns for self-defense? But we aren't exactly pulling our piece on a regular basis every day.
Background checks are quick and easy because almost everyone in Oregon lives within 10 miles of a licensed gun dealer.
Well, quick and easy if it all works out. Still, what if you are one of the many who live within the 10-mile radius they talk about? Never mind the 5% that who live further than that. We're still talking a major road trip to make a legal sale. And that's if everything goes well. Remember, Moms Demand Illegal Mayors for Every Town, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg Incorporated, is demanding that people who get a hold on their background check not get the gun until the ATF gives an affirmative response. Which, when we look at the famous case of the Charleston racist shooter, would have never happened, as the ATF and FBI were asleep at the switch on that one.
Background checks are good for public safety. In states that close the loophole, there's less gun trafficking and fewer police officers shot and killed in the line of duty.
Note that he is citing statistics given by Bloomberg himself. So Bloomberg's own numbers. No bias there. Also, as you might guess, the data is pretty crappy. The trafficking report is purely speculative, as they simply assume what recovered crime guns were trafficked and which weren't. And the law enforcement killed is a total mess, as the number of states that require background checks for handgun sales is much smaller than the states that don't restrict legal private transfers, but the number of officers in both sets are about the same. So that's more cops in a smaller area. And the number of officers killed in the line of duty by other means other than a gun are much higher in the non-background check group. Messy data, and a biased source. Again, this is another feel-good law that won't really stop criminals, but will fall squarely on the shoulders of the lawful citizens.
Alright, Weird. It was good to talk with you. See you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host at The Squirrel Report and blogs at WeirdWorld.com. That's WeirdWorld.com. I think it's worth noting that since Weird recorded that, John Lott, who we spoke about earlier, released his views on this more police officers die garbage and said basically they misused the data to the point of it didn't say what they said it meant.
Of course.
I think they, well, you know, they come from the torture of the data until it confesses school.
Right, kind of like, so when he said that, I was like, oh, well, they probably used the data from last year, which had, as we talked about earlier, many podcasts ago, last year was the lowest number of police officer deaths in 50 years. So if you pass a law that says you got to have universal background checks, and then the next year you have the fewest number of deaths in 50 years nationwide, even in places that didn't have this thing, you can say, oh, look, we passed this law, and then this happened. I think that's called a logical fallacy.
My dad always called it lying, and I got spankings for that, too. The next little section may be a little bit beyond what you may wish to allow your children to listen. So if you're in the car listening with the kids, hit the pause and wait until you have a little bit of time to listen to this alone. It's not exactly not safe for work, but maybe the little ones don't need to hear it.
Yeah.
Stuff that grinds my gears. This one just pissed me straight the heck off. Why are feminists slut-shaming the Planned Parenthood whistleblower? We've talked about this before, you and I, Adam.
Yes.
Neither one of us is going to make the mistake of watching any more of these Planned Parenthood videos. I watched one. I'm done. And you are smart enough to avoid even that one.
Yeah, I saw something like this about 20 years ago, and I don't need to see it again.
Nope. And whatever you imagine a baby parts spread out across a Petri dish looks like, that's, yeah, you don't need to see that. The most recent video apparently has a woman who says, well, you know, they had babies that were born with a heartbeat, and we made sure they died. And we cut their faces off and pulled out their brains, and we did it that way so that we could get the brain intact. And I'm not entirely certain how to take that. I am not overly excited about abortion one way or the other. If you're going to have an abortion, fine, just don't make me pay for it. I'm not going to approve of it. I'm not going to think it's a good idea. I'm not going to say, hey, good for you. But I'm not going to stand in the door trying to keep you out either. I can understand that people have different opinions. Great. But I think we can kind of draw the line at cutting babies' faces off and sucking their brains out and doing it that way so that we can get it intact.
So that we can make money off of it.
I you know what? I don't care if you do that for free.
Is it worse if you do it for free? Does that make you...
I don't, you know, I'm not sure which is worth. You know, am I doing it for cash? Am I doing it just for the thrill of it? Or I don't care. It's not the making money of it that bothers me. It's the cutting the baby's face off with a pair of scissors that bothers me.
Yeah.
Well, what bothers me even more, if that's possible, is that there exists a group of people who believe that because this woman told the researchers what had happened, having worked there for some period of time and having participated in this sort of thing, says this is what we did, they felt, well, here's a wonderful idea. Let's go through this woman's past, drag out anything we think we can use to humiliate her, and dump it into the public. We're not talking like, oh, here's her address and phone number, call her and give her a bad time, or go to her house and, you know, throw tomatoes at her. It was fairly graphic stuff that they pulled out of a couple of websites. Now, the first one, they went to her OkCupid account and pulled out information from the OkCupid account, which is creepy and, you know, kind of dumb, but not really
like,
disgusting.
Oh, she had a dating profile. Okay.
Yeah, you know, looking at her, she's a reasonably attractive girl. She's fairly young, so she's probably not in the age group. She's at the age group where she's looking to find somebody a little longer term. I understand that. And, you know, how many men that you want to have a relationship with are you going to meet at a Planned Parenthood clinic?
Yeah, probably not ripe for dating.
No, that's not where I would look. What really, really bugged me was that they looked up a site called FetLife. If you don't know what FetLife is, not really sure how to explain it to you, you can look it up or you cannot look it up on your own. Definitely don't let your kids go to it. This is a very adult thing. And it is kind of, sort of, a Facebook for, well, Fet is short for fetish. And then they took the information in her profile that they had to work for. It's not like it's under her real name. Everybody has a handle, a fake name. They took this information and published it. What particularly she was interested in.
So, and the other thing is that they did this in order to basically say, oh, look, so all of these religious people who don't like Planned Parenthood, they're using this woman who is freaky deaky to, you know, further their cause. Don't you feel bad about using, you know, doesn't that somehow make you a hypocrite? Like, well, you know, it's not like, you know, a group of Catholics put somebody undercover for 2.5 years doing all of these things, right?
No.
And then came out and said, oh, look at what we've discovered while we were there. Look at all these horrible things that I did. No. There is no way that I could stomach doing that. Right? Like, I couldn't go into Planned Parenthood and spy on them for 2 years, right?
Right.
I couldn't do that.
Right.
But somebody who didn't really have a problem with it when they went in and suddenly saw what was going on and then developed a problem with it and came back out, that sounds pretty plausible to me. And what kind of person do you think would go and work at Planned Parenthood? Do you think, you know, your local Baptist deacon's daughter? Probably not.
There's two things here that I think show a very narrow focus of, you know, a narrow mindset of the people who are making this argument. One is the one you're talking about, is that we should, as, you know, good God-fearing Christians or whatever they think of us, people who object to cutting babies' faces off and yanking their brains out, we should be repulsed. And, you know, we should not put this person forward. We should say, oh, she's tainted, so therefore anything she says is tainted. Kind of weird logical thought process is that. Number two is a complete and utter misunderstanding of what it is to be conservative, to be a libertarian conservative, to say that, oh, all you guys are a bunch of freaky, weird Christian people who don't do anything but, you know, sex in the missionary position with the lights out, the blinds drawn, and only to produce children. Are you stupid? That's not how we roll at all. I mean, there might be a few like that, but I don't know them, because that sort of people aren't going to tell me about that sort of thing.
Right.
So I know what FetLife is, and it's not like it's on that long list of things that, you know, we study before we start a podcast. I knew what that was long before that this story came out. So, you know, work it out yourself. How many people who may object to this sort of behavior know all about this website, know all about this sort of lifestyle choices that could be made, and are totally okay with that? So, you know, maybe some of these people need to get out from behind their really weird tunnel view of their opposition. Or maybe they shouldn't, because that's how you lose. If you don't understand your opposition, then how can you possibly defeat them?
Right.
So what do you got this week?
This freaking guy. So I took a picture on my way home from work today, and it'll be in the show notes. Basically, there's a guy on a bicycle in traffic wearing a bright yellow jersey, and he's in traffic. I took this picture at 5:25 p.m., by the way. So what do we call that?
Rush hour.
Right. He's on the main thoroughfare. And Sean, do you see what's to the right of him?
A white line.
And?
A gutter.
And?
A curb.
And?
A little bit of grass.
And?
And a big, wide, freaking bike lane.
That's right. There's a multi-million dollar bike lane so that he doesn't have to stop traffic, and he's not using it. Don't be that guy.
Well, that's our show for the week. Thanks again to Rob Allen for our music, and thank you for listening to the Gunblog Variety Cast. Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at SeanSorrentino.com and hate mail to WizardPC at GunsCarsTech.com. Show notes can be found at GunblogVarietyCast.com/episode 53.